This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. We're going to talk today to Peter Blauner, who hasn't had a book in quite some time. His new book is called Proving Ground. It is a novel out from Minotaur Books and hopefully the start of a series. Hello.
Hi, how are you, David?
Hi. So that's the first question. Is this the start of a series?
Yes. Well, it's not a traditional series. What it is that I am carrying over the female detective, Lourdes Robles, who appears in this first book, Proving Ground, and she will be in the next book that I'm going to write. However, this is not really like a traditional private eye or police detective kind of book in that she is not the sole point of view in Proving Ground. She's just one of the points of view.
Yeah, because her cohort, the guy, what's his name now? I'm forgetting his name.
Nathaniel Dresden, a.k.a. Natty Dresden.
No, I'm talking about her, the guy that she, the other police officer.
Kevin Sullivan.
Yeah, he's interesting, too. I think he needs to come back, too.
Though he can't come back as a police detective in the next book, because I've sort of established that he's in his early 60s. Retirement age.
But he's so interesting, Peter. I think you got to do something with the guy.
Well, you can come back as a DA's investigator after that age, but on your 63rd birthday, you're done.
is that the way it really is nowadays?
Yep, that's it. A lot of people get out before then. They get their 20, and then they're done. But I know a few guys who put in close to 40 years in the job.
That's a lot of years for a job that can be as stressful as that job can be.
True, but if you're into it, it's like every day you have a front row seat at the circus, and I've heard a lot of people say that. And that's
oh, really?
Yeah.
I never heard it quite put like that before.
Well, if you're willing to sort of like, I mean, there's a lot of tragedy, and I'm not downplaying that at all. But having done ride-alongs and also having been a reporter in the old days, being able to get out in the world and go through people's doors and see what other people's lives are like, it's the life of kings. It's a privilege.
But didn't you feel like you were intruding, though?
Sometimes that is the reality of it, and other times people want that, the police are there, or the press is there, because all the other institutions and all the other aspects of society have failed them in some way, and they want somebody to see what's going on in their lives.
Well, what was it like? I guess you saw a lot of blood then.
Well, it's not so much the blood. It's more just the sorrows and tragedy, but also the humanity of people's lives, and also sometimes the decency in unexpected moments, and also their willingness to share their stories.
But you're also going into dangerous neighborhoods at times too.
Well, you know, that's not as dangerous as they were when I first started writing in the 80s. I get to go home. Those people live there, so why shouldn't I put something on the line if I'm willing to tell their stories?
That's true.
That seems like a fair trade to me.
That's true. I don't think I'd want to be a reporter in, like, the Philly area, because downtown Philly is kind of scary at night.
Yeah.
They always tell you how beautiful the city is, but they're talking about when it's lit up and when everybody's happy and walking, and, you know, but they're not talking about at night when all the... Well, you know, the strange people come out.
That's true, but that's often where you hear the really compelling stories. The best writer's workshop that I ever taught by a country mile was on Rikers Island. I taught a workshop where I taught 20 guys, and they came up with stories that literally most of the writers that I know would kill to have. they just had them at their fingertips easily. Any problem that you might have with your prose style is not really noticeable if you have a compelling story to tell.
I have to thank you for getting me this book. I have trouble getting through to St. Martin's. You did it, and bam, it was here the next day. I hardly ever have that happen.
Well, they've been great, and they've been very, very supportive of the book.
That's because it's a great book. I mean, who wouldn't be supportive of this? It's terrific. It's a terrific novel. I mean, I found myself so compelled in reading it. I have to know what happens to these characters because I've invested time in this, and now I'm really interested.
Well, good. I'm glad it paid off in that way.
It was different than I expected. I didn't know what to expect going into this book. I thought, well, you know, you read a police procedural, and they can be really dull if they're not written well. They can be kind of dull. And to be able to tell a really good story with really interesting characters is not easy to do.
Well, thank you. That's part of why I do all that research, because I don't want to just borrow from other books or borrow from television shows, some of which I've written for, or borrow from movies. The only way to make sure that you're avoiding a cliche is to go to real life, because that always will be fresh and unexpected.
So, you're doing what it seems like a lot of guys are doing, writing for TV and writing books, too, when they have a moment.
Yes. Though I did take an extended leave from TV writing. I had a year where I had left Law & Order SVU, and a year before I joined Blue Blood, where I just focused on writing the book and where there was nothing else.
So you work closely with Tom Selleck, or did you?
I have worked with Tom Selleck. I've been on the set with Tom. I write for him, and
that's got to be exciting to do that. I mean, to work for somebody. I mean, and he's so well known. I mean, he's such a major part of all of our lives, you know.
And
he seems like such a nice fellow. I mean, just like a really down to earth. I mean, you always see him on TV, and he looks so serious. You know, but you know,
he's a real pro. He's a real pro.
And at 70 years old, he's still going strong. I mean,
he looks a lot younger than that when you're around him. And he's a substantial gentleman. Sometimes you meet actors and they're rather small people, but Tom has a real imposing physical presence, and he uses that very, very well.
And I think it's going into what, its seventh season next year?
I think this is season 8 that's going
in. Is it 8 already?
Yeah. Yep. But the previous show I worked for, Law & Order SVU, just finished their 18th.
That's insane.
Yeah.
How does a show last 18 years? I mean, how do you keep up the quality of a show for 18 years?
In that case, it's because the star of the show, Mariska Hargitay, comes out of the dressing room every single day with real energy and enthusiasm and determination to do the best show that she can. And I'm not just saying that.
Well, you must have written well for her, because without the writing, what do you have?
You have some good-looking people.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, the writing is, the story is everything. If you watch a show on TV, it's got to have a good story. I turn it off if it doesn't have a good story. If it gets stupid or silly, you know, I'm done with it. And at least for that week. It doesn't mean I wouldn't go back another time, but it's got to have a good story. It's got to be something interesting happening.
I think you can usually tell within the first 5-10 minutes whether they've got it going on week from week. I've been lucky to work with some very good people on both those shows.
Have you ever, on Law & Order, did you ever write for anybody famous? I mean, any famous guest stars that you enjoyed writing for?
Well, on both those shows, I've written for, I just finished an episode of Blue Bloods where we had three long and I thought really masterful scenes between Tom and Stacy Keach.
Oh, wow.
Who is a fantastic, fantastic actor whose career goes back to the 60s and television. I mean, some people just know him from Mike Hammer.
Oh, yeah.
Just a tiny sliver of what he did because he's a very, very accomplished Shakespeare actor. He's a great film actor. And also one of the best audiobooks I've ever heard is his version of Hemingway's short stories.
What fun that must have been to write that scene.
Yeah, it was terrific. significant just to see those two guys work and really just hold the camera. You felt like you were on the set of a big budget movie. The time just sort of.
Are you nervous writing scenes like that? Are you nervous how they'll take them or how they'll react to them? Or is it pretty well?
I don't think you can get nervous or self-conscious about that kind of thing. You just try and hear the actor's voice and try and keep that in your head, and that's more what I try and focus on, because it's not like writing for the page where I'm just trying to have the reality of the situation.
Well, Proving Ground is so interesting. I mean, it's just a book that you can delve into. I mean, it's 50 chapters, but it's a joy to read it because it's just so interesting. I mean, Natty is such you don't know how to take Natty at first.
Well, that's the best kind of character, where you don't know if somebody's a good guy or a bad guy, or maybe they're both, or maybe they change from one to the other, because, you know, a lot of us are kind of complicated like that.
Even his mother is. I'm not even sure. I have mixed reactions to her, too. I
mean, yeah.
There are times in the book I think, oh, you're an idiot. And then other times I like her. And then, but you find yourself vacillating between that through the whole book, which is interesting. And when you're getting reactions, when you're feeling reactions to the characters, that means the writer's doing his job.
I hope so. Again, to me, I want to create the experience that you might have in getting to know somebody who you might run into in the office or a neighbor or something like that, where at times you think, I feel very warmly towards this person, and other times you feel like, well, maybe I don't trust them that much, and then other times you think, well, maybe I got them wrong. Maybe they really are a good person.
So was your last book really 11 years ago?
It was.
So why the gap, other than the TV writing? Is that what stopped you from writing?
No, there's another book that I've been writing on and off, which is eventually going to come to fruition, but is very different and very ambitious, and that's part of the reason why I went into TV writing in the first place. And at a certain point, I realized I wanted to go back to what I had done before, which was...
weren't you afraid people would forget your name?
Well, I don't really think about that at all. I mean, it's more about writing the best book I have in me at any individual.
I mean, I didn't forget about you. I saw the new book. I was excited. I thought, wow, I'm glad he's back.
Listen, I've never been about, like, just putting out product for the sake of being on the
market. No, absolutely not.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't do that even if I wanted to. It would be smart commercially to do that, but I think, like, the cruddiness of it would be apparent to everyone and not just me. So I think I just needed to wait until I really felt like I had something to say. And when I say something to say...
Well, at least you're not writing a book with Bill Clinton, that's for sure.
Well, no.
but I don't know. I'm really bothered by that, I must admit.
Why?
Why am I bothered by it? Because I just feel like... I don't know. I just feel like it makes my stomach turn for some reason. And
I couldn't write a book with anybody. I the whole point of writing books for me is that it's different from writing television, where it's a collaborative meeting.
You write books and you have characters and you have a good story. That's not always true about that other guy. You know, we both know who I'm talking about. I'm not going to name any names, but the story is so important. The characters, they can't be one dimensional. In so many of his books, they're one dimensional. And I'm sorry, that's just the way I feel. But I can feel that. I have a right to feel that way as a reader.
Sure. Well, I can only speak for myself, which is I can only begin to write a book when I begin to feel like I understand this particular person's way of looking at the world, and it's not necessarily a point of view that I've seen before in a book. And that's more important than the specifics of the crime, if you know what I mean. Like, a lot of this book is...
Every one of these characters in your book is troubled in some way. They've got problems, which is true of life. That's the way life is. Everybody's troubled by something. We just don't know what it is. But, I mean, Natty is a very troubled... And I love the way you... I mean, we get to see what he's been through in the military. I mean, what what this man has, what the horrors that he has seen, we get to see that vividly. And I like the fact that you bring that to the forefront. Because I think sometimes you forget. You think military, I mean, there's so many people that have been through the military nowadays. You kind of forget how awful it really can be.
Well, that's why I hesitated at first to write this kind of character. I never thought I would write a main character. And he is as much the main character in the book, maybe even more so than Lourdes, who's coming back. But I hesitated to write about somebody who'd been in a war. And at first I thought it was, because morally I kind of felt like I don't have a right to do this because I didn't serve myself. And then I realized what it really was is that I didn't want to do it because I didn't think I could compete with people who've been there and come back.
Oh, no, you do it really well. I mean, and you do it differently than I've seen in any other book. I mean, there are flashbacks. If Michael Connelly's character was in the... And he has flashbacks, but it's not the same thing. Yours is much more vivid, and I can actually, I sense the horror that he's been through.
Oh, good. That's what I wanted. But I didn't want to have the whole book take place on the battlefield, because there it'd be apparent that I don't know as much as a Norman Mailer did writing about World War II. Actually, Irwin Shaw wrote a great World War II book called The Young Lions. Some of the Vietnam writers or some of the younger writers are coming back now from Afghanistan and Iraq. But so the whole idea was to do a post-war novel rather than a war novel, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and the first chapter starts out with we see what he has been through.
Yeah.
A major, major problem. And I was a little confused by that chapter at first, the prologue. And I'm not a big prologue person a lot of times, and I don't know why. I get very annoyed by prologues. But after I got through the prologue, I was fine. I mean, I realized, oh, good, there's a good story I can sink my teeth into. But I always feel like, wait a minute, what have I missed here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of the great noir stuff was written around World War II, or right before World War II, or right afterwards. And so I was a little bit conscious of that as well, that there's something about the psychological atmosphere that, you know, comes back to America.
So you weren't in, were you in the military?
No. Never.
One would swear you were by reading this book.
Oh, good. I hope that comes off.
I thought to myself, he's got to have been in the military.
It's like, no, I just spend a lot of time doing research and talking to veterans who were generous enough to open up to me and share their experience and share their perceptions, which was just as important and a lot.
And some of those are in the book, actually?
Yeah, definitely.
Wow, that makes it even more powerful to realize it really happened. And I guess we know it. What's that movie that just came out with Mel Gibson? Mel Gibson's movie, Hacksaw Ridge.
Hacksaw Ridge, yeah, it's a World War II story, right?
Amazing, amazing movie. I mean, there are parts of that that are just overwhelming to watch.
Well, whenever you're writing about something like war, my point of view is you have to find a way to make it seem new again and to open the reader's eyes and to find the detail or the angle into the story that the reader hasn't considered before. Because otherwise, it's like, well, we've been here, done this, what are you talking?
When did the idea take place for this book? Has it been a number of years, or was it just recently?
It was actually not that long ago. I was, to be honest, I was in a meeting, story meeting for somebody else's script for Law and Order Special Victims Unit. And in this particular case, I have to give credit that Warren Light, who was the showrunner, had a meeting that all the other writers attended in which a couple of experts in post-traumatic stress disorder from the Veterans Administration spoke to us about writing sensitively from the veteran's point of view. And something that one of the experts said really got my attention, which is that upon returning from war, a veteran's perspective on the world will be filtered through what he has experienced in the war. And as I walked out of the office, I saw a garbage bag on the street, and I thought, like, and I remember something I'd heard one of the veterans say, a veteran say once, that like he swerved around a garbage bag whenever he saw one unattended on the street, because in his mind's eye, that became an improvised explosive device of the kind that he'd seen on the streets of Iraq. And then when I got that picture in my mind, I was like, I could imagine being that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I'd had those traumatic experiences, somebody sent me, a former soldier that I met sent me a video, and it was just driving down a street, I think in Ramadi, and it's just a typical afternoon, and they're just driving along for 30 or 40 seconds, and it's long enough that you start to get a little bit bored, and you start to think it's just a street, I see the houses, I see the chickens, I see somebody riding by on a bicycle, and then all of a sudden, it blows up. There's no dramatic music setting you up like you would in a movie. It's as if you were just like driving down the street and all of a sudden you found yourself driving through the middle of the sun. Everything is on fire and everything that you had established as the foundation of reality just blew up around you. And it was so shocking and so stunning that I realized, I don't really know what that's like. I've never had that experience of reality just being torn away.
So writing this book was sort of like experiencing it then.
Yes, yes. And I'm looking for those moments where I kind of go, now I understand why this character looks at the world this way. That's as important to me as, like, this book, you know, opens with the murder of Natty's father, and Natty trying to find out who killed his father. And all that's important. I'm not saying that part of the story isn't important. But what I'm also trying to get to is that state of mind that Natty is in when that happens. And in order to understand that, you have to go back to the war.
Well, you're really great with confrontations and characters, and that's really important, too. This idea, and Tana French did it really well in her last book, too,
mm-hmm.
The Trespasser, amazing book. But the you can, characters that you can't wait to see how they confront each other, what they're going to say to each other,
yeah.
How they're going to react to each other, that's so important. And that's so much makes the book more fun to read.
Well, I think there's a famous quote from the filmmaker, I think it was Renoir, who said, everyone has their reasons. So I try and give every character their reasons. I don't try and have a villain who's twirling his mustache. I mean, the bad guy doesn't think of himself as the bad guy. So,
that's a solid point. That's a very interesting point. That the bad, and that's true. That's true of so many people in life. You see them,
right.
And you'll, like, I had a friend who told me that she used to go into Kmart and switch prices. And I said to her, "You did what?" And I was horrified that somebody that I knew that well would do something like that.
Why'd she do it?
To save money, obviously.
She switched prices on the stuff.
Yeah, she wanted something that was too expensive.
She didn't just do it to create chaos. That's what I thought.
No, she did it to save money. She wanted
that would have been the more interesting thing. Just to
but I was horrified. I said, no way you did that. And I was just really upset with her because I didn't think of her as being like that. And yet
we have this
image of our friends as being these perfect individuals that don't make mistakes. But we forget, you know, these people have lives. Maybe she didn't have a lot of money at that point. And maybe there was some extenuating circumstances. I don't know. But it still horrifies me to think about it.
Well, that's when I try and go into each scene with a sense of these two characters who have conflicting sets of reasons and that each of them feel completely justified in the way they're acting, and then you have a really strong scene if you put those two people
and you have, and you're looking forward to that scene.
You can't
wait till they finally butt heads, you know. It's like watching those animal videos on Mutual of Oklahoma. The animals go after each other, you know. It's kind of interesting to watch. You want to see how they react toward one another, and that's what makes a really great book too. I mean, that's one of the ingredients of a book that makes it so much fun. That's why Tana French's book is so amazing. She's got so many interrogation scenes where you just feel this, I can't wait to see what happens in this scene.
Yeah, those are some of the most interesting.
I don't know how she does it, but she did it so well the last book. Amazing, amazing book. But Proving Ground, it's just so interesting from beginning to end, and it leaves an indelible impression on you, too, after you read it.
Well, I hope so.
It definitely does.
It's great if people like take it on vacation and read it on an airplane.
Oh, yeah.
Or whatever. But if it does leave a little bit of an impression on you, well, then that means that I've done my job. Because if I'm asking you to invest the time it takes to read a book and to spend the money to read a book, I should be giving you a little bit more than just a moment of entertainment, I feel.
Now, did Dennis Lehane read your book?
I believe so.
And that's his impression.
He spoke kindly of it. I think he's a man of integrity.
That's amazing. I want to read his new book. His new book sounds fascinating.
Yeah, sounds great. He's a really, really good writer.
Oh, you haven't read it yet?
No, not yet. Okay. But I've read a lot of his other books.
I love getting first impressions of books from other people.
He's a terrific, terrific writer.
I mean, Mystic River is a masterpiece as far as I'm concerned.
I think that is one of the best books of the last, I was going to say 25 years. Yeah, I think we're still within 25 years.
I've had some weird experiences with Dennis Lehane. He came to a signing one time in Bryn Mawr, and the lady that was organizing it unfortunately invited all these other authors, and he didn't know it. And it was quite unpleasant for him. I still feel bad to this day for him because he's so great to come, you know. And it was like, oh, what did we do to this poor man, you know? And she only wanted to have, you know, different people. She wanted to be nice to everybody, and I guess she didn't think that it would bother him, but it did. And you know, as a writer, I guess you have some kind of an ego. But I mean, how much of one, I don't know. And I'm not saying he does. I don't know him well enough to know whether he does or not. But it just seemed, it was just a shame, the whole thing. But do you have an ego as a writer?
Well, I must. otherwise, I wouldn't put my name in big letters on the book.
What it is? I didn't think they were that big.
But I try and make that ego disappear, I hope, when I'm actually writing the book and enter into other people's lives.
I mean, but are you like that on the set of Blue Bloods? Are you like a little full of yourself?
Well, you wouldn't last very long on the set.
You really are. You're admitting it. Wow.
With a bunch of well-known actors and a director, I mean, it's not really your job when you're on the set of a television show.
But at the same time, would they ever come?
To say how things should go and shouldn't go. I mean, that's where I get to have that kind of ego when I run the book. When you write the book, you're the producer, the director, and the main actor.
But have you ever had a situation where somebody came up to you and said, oh, that writing sucks, why did you write it like that, or that you really messed that up? Have they ever done that to you?
Well, not in those exact words, but there are occasions when there are serious discussions. That's not unfamiliar to me.
Right. You seem like such a trooper. I mean, you have the confidence. I can hear it in your voice. You're very confident. You're a confident writer, and obviously with Proving Ground, you've proved it. You are a good writer. And
well, you know, if you sort of have hung in there for, I've been writing since the early '80s as a journalist, and you have to have some confidence in what you're doing, or else.
But I've had authors
lie down in a dark room and never come out again.
I mean, right. Well, I've had some authors.
A lot of rejection. I mean, along the way, because that's part of what it's about too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've had authors tell me that every book they lose confidence. They're like, well, are people going to like this? They're sort of paranoid about it.
Well, that can put you on edge and up to a point in a way that's productive, because that makes you feel like, all right, how can I push this further? How can I make it better? How can I anticipate what somebody's objection will be? If you can keep that on the right side of keeping you from getting paralyzed, then that can be a useful thing. If it gets you to the point that you're so self-conscious that you can't write well, that's no good.
Do you ever worry about how your readers are going to think of your characters? Does that ever come into play?
The only time I get in trouble, and the kind of thing that I try to avoid, and it's really a difference between writing for television and writing for the book, is when people start to talk about this issue of likability. That's where I really...
But if you read a book and you don't like any of the characters, are you likely to finish that book? I mean, that's the question, I guess. And I'm not saying there are definitely characters in this book you can like. I like Lourdes. I like the way she is. I mean, she's very unorthodox, but I still like the way she is. But yes, are there some characters in this book that make me mad? Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, I don't think I could read a book where I didn't find any of the characters interesting. But that's different from likable. If you say likable, that is where I break down on that whole issue.
But here, I mean,
somebody that you think is likable, I may not like at all.
Well, let's take Jack Reacher, for instance. And there's a man who's killed I don't know how many people.
Right.
And yet people consider him a hero.
Right. Well, then you consider him interesting because he is.
He is interesting, but he's nothing less than a murderer, though, too.
Right, but that's more important. But there you go again, because the interestingness is more important than somebody's subjective point of view.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Or not, you know what I mean?
You're saying it's more important that he's actually.
You want to see what he's going to do.
He's interesting.
Next.
It's more important that he's interesting rather than likable, is what you're saying.
Yeah, rather than somebody who you want to live next door to.
But I mean, isn't it interesting how people, it doesn't matter if you have done horrible things, people can still look up to you.
Yeah. Well, it all depends on the context
right.
and the way it's presented and the reason for it. Like we say, everybody has his or her reasons. I always try and balance that. That's more important to me, whether I believe in this character's reasons rather than I hope my readers will like this person because they have a dog and they're
right,
nice to their
exactly.
mother. Because once I start to think that way, I'm dead as a writer. I mean, I'm not into ingratiating myself because it's not going to work.
There's a scene in John Sanford's Prey book, I think it was Extreme Prey, where he guts a rabbit right in the middle of the beginning of the book. He guts a rabbit, and it's done very, very horribly. I mean, he describes how the rabbit's feeling and everything, and it's horrible.
Wow.
And I read that, and I love Don Sanford. I read practically everything he writes with the Prey series anyway. But I thought to myself, oh my God, this is going to turn a lot of people off, and yet. And I still remember the scene, and it bothers me, and I can still see the look of fear on that rabbit.
But, well, the most important thing is just to make sure that, like, you're not boring the reader.
But was it interesting? Oh, yes, definitely interesting. But is it upsetting? Yes. So do you have to know where the line is? You don't want to upset your readers too much.
Do
you?
Maybe yes, maybe no, but in the truth is, I always feel... If I haven't done something that either comes very close to the line or maybe crosses the line a little bit, I haven't done my job.
It's more real? Are you saying it's more real?
Yeah, it's more real. I would never write anything grotesque for the sake of just being grotesque.
And you never, like, kill an animal in your books?
Not just for the sake of doing it.
I think
I've been around the real thing too much to be comfortable.
I think the point of it was that he wanted to show how brutal this character really was.
Yeah. Okay. I get that. I get that.
And it's very apparent right away how brutal this woman is. So,
right.
But it upset me terribly. I know, because I have this. When you have a love for animals, it's hard not to feel for them. You know. Especially, I mean, I think he actually described the animal knowing that they were going to die, and that really upsets me.
Yeah.
And it gets to me like I've never. And I think to myself, well, and I know why you put it in there. Obviously, that's the reason, to show the brutality. But you think to yourself, is it necessary to do that? Is it really? But I mean, you have things that happen in this book that are shocking.
Yeah, I hope so.
They definitely are shocking things, and then one in particular I can't go into.
But I hope that they're all in the context of the story and the characters, that sometimes you'll read something gross in a book and you'll go like, yeah, that's the author just trying to be a naughty little boy or a naughty little girl, or they're just offending me. And that you can sort of see the author being manipulative and trying to shock the audience, whereas I'm trying to do that kind of thing to let you see the reality of these people's lives and to let you understand why they act the way that they do.
And it's interesting how during the course of this book we really get to see a glimpse of what his father was like.
Yeah.
Slowly but surely we get to see how they related to each other, how his death is affecting him. And it's a very slow process. He doesn't seem really upset in the beginning about his father. But as he finds out more stuff, I think it becomes more, and I still see that the scene with him, you know, handing his father the briefcase, and I think to myself, that's a very, very visual thing that you can just sense. And you mentioned it a couple times in the book.
Yeah.
And it just sticks with me, and I think, wow, I was never like that with my father. I was never that close with my father. I don't know what your experience was, but
well, I want to create those little moments that you feel the real intimacy between the characters, for better or worse. And I was trying to create the complexity of a particularly troubled father-son relationship, where Natty and his father are very much at odds and estranged when Dad is alive.
It's a shame we didn't. It's a shame we don't get to see Dad alive, because that he would be a very interesting character to write a book about.
Yeah. Well, maybe there's a way to go back in time at some point. But you know, my thing is that, okay, here's a guy who's a civil rights activist, who's a criminal defense lawyer as well, and who stands up for the rights of the underdog as well as those who are maybe actually guilty, and his son goes against him and goes in the exact opposite direction and goes into the military.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been this great breach between them. And when the father is murdered, he can never be healed. And there can never be a true reconciliation, except, and the closest the son can come is by finding out who killed his father.
Well, the idea that Natty has upset his mother terribly by going into the military, and his father's kind of resigned to it. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of an interesting change. You see both sides.
Yeah.
You know, and is he trying to make his father mad? Is he trying to upset his mother? And, you know, that's the questions you ask yourself. I mean, what's his point? Or is his point only to serve his country?
Well, you have to read the book and, like, see it through his eyes to come up with that answer. I don't want it to be obvious, because it might not be obvious. It might not be obvious even to the person who's made that decision.
Right.
Because that's often the way...
I have to be careful I don't give away too much here.
Yeah. But it's often the way that people look back and go, the reason why I made a decision like that is actually this, and I thought it was that. And so I'm trying to create that sense of time and distance as well.
But when you really get into a story, you must enjoy telling it, because you do it so well. I mean, it's so compelling. Like I said, this book goes from chapter 1 to chapter 50, and I couldn't wait to see how it was going to turn out, what's going to happen at the end. You feel things slowly building to a climax, and it does build to a climax, and you're just not sure what that climax is and what's going to happen.
Good, because the reader knows 100 pages before you get there, you have failed, my friend. So
now you've written how many books now?
This is my 7th book.
So is there an idea for the next Lourdes book?
Yes, there definitely is.
Is it a clear all the way through idea, or just a beginning of an idea?
No, this is an unusually clear idea. So hopefully I won't get confused in the next few months. Or
but I wonder.
I'm on too many detours, because I better get it done quickly.
I can't ask that question, or I'm gonna. You probably yell at me if I ask that question. But it's a detail in the book I don't want to give away. But I don't want to bring that up. But it makes me ask the question of who's going to be in the next book with her. So, but I don't think we can even talk about that.
All right, I don't want to give it away. Don't
yeah, it's too much to talk about. But it makes me very curious. So you'll have to let me know another way. But you had a party at Otto Penzler's store, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
You must have gotten a huge reaction from that.
Well, it was very nice because, you know, I've done a lot of different things in my life. I started off as a journalist in New York Magazine, and then obviously I've written these six novels up until Proving Ground. And then for the last 10 years, I've worked in television. And people from all those different phases of my life showed up and were really wonderfully supportive, plus, you know, friends and family. So it was really a great evening. And also it was great to do it at Otto Penzler's.
What percentage of the people that showed up would you say have read the book, do you think?
Well, I don't think any. I think hardly. hardly anybody had read the book.
I wish I'd been there.
it was the day of publication, May 2nd.
One of the joys about loving a book is being able to tell other people how much you loved it. You know, and that's...
I can't do that with my own book, but yes, I love doing that with other people.
Sure you can. There's no... People just think you're touting it. Just to tout it.
It's like trying to tell people you're attractive.
Well, look at Harlan Coben did it. Look where he got.
Well, no, well, Harlan's got a right to say that. Harlan's a terrific, terrific writer. I mean, you know.
But he was doing it at the very beginning.
Well, if it's working for him, then God bless him. But
I agree. I love Harlan.
He's got the goods. I wish I had his.
Don't you feel like you have the goods too?
Well, and maybe if I do, it's in a different way, I think. But Harlan just has an amazing ability to plant the question in a reader's mind just before they get to the end of the chapter that really forces you to go on to that next chapter, even though you really know that you should be in bed with the lights out.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's got the addictive thing down in a way that I can only...
I've only had a problem with one of his books, and every other book I've read has been a joy to read. And he is one of those authors that, and he's a very visual writer. In other words, there's always photographs in his books. There's always something about a photograph or something online that's seen, or somebody seen that you thought was dead, and he does that so well.
Yeah, no, just he asks interesting questions, and I'd say that's like really one of his great talents.
So, what is your idea to write 10 books in this series?
I don't know if I could get to 10 books in the series because, a novel has to be about the way someone changes. And if someone is going through 10 major changes in their life, there's something really wrong with them.
There you go. That's a point.
So we'll see how far I can take it. And in some cases, like in this book, Proving Ground, that we're talking about, the person who goes through the major change in the book is not Lourdes, it's Natty. And that's part of the reason why Lourdes is sort of not necessarily the sole main character of the book. She definitely has some place to pick up and go to.
I love this scene, and I can't really describe it because I'll give something away, but I love the scene where she's having... shall we say, fantasies.
Yeah.
I think to myself, oh my God, what is going on with her? You know?
Yeah, she's. I hope I've made her an interesting enough character and that I've left some questions unanswered about her that I can go on to.
And or the scene where she comes home and there's somebody in the bathroom and it's like, wow, this is a pretty powerful scene. And as you describe it more and more, you start to realize, wow, what does this woman go through at home?
Yep. I'm pretty sympathetic because she's a character who comes from the projects and whose family background is a tough one, and who has persisted and really made something of herself in spite of the odds.
Right. Now, do you have a title for the second one yet?
Nah, not yet.
Do you have any ideas?
I have some ideas, but they could change so much.
I don't want to say.
It's like saying that you're going to write a book about golf, and then it ends up being about alligators.
Do you think it'll be out the same time next year? This time?
I don't think so. I think it's going to take a little longer than that. But again,
can you tell how anxious I am to read it?
Well, I'm getting anxious to write it, which is a good sign.
It is a good sign. So you like being anxious.
Yeah. Up to a certain point.
But when you write a book as opposed to when you write a TV show, are you writing the TV show at home also, or are you writing it at the studio?
No, I always write at home, but when you write a TV show, you have to have the conversation with the showrunner and sometimes with the other writers to come up with what the battle plan is.
Especially if you're going to kill a character off.
Just to have a basic idea of how it's going to fit in with the rest of the show and with the schedule and with the budget. And there's a lot of other people who have to be part of the decision making there, whereas when you write a novel, that's just you and you alone.
So are you now focused on writing books, or are you still working on Blue Bloods?
Actually, I am taking off the first part of this season 8 to write the next book. I will be coming back for the second half of.
Is it as fulfilling to do that as it was to write for the TV?
Oh, it's fulfilling and satisfying. No knock on my TV friends at all, but this ultimately is what is the main form of satisfaction for me as a writer, being able to have complete ownership over the story and the characters, and if it doesn't work, it's my fault, and there's no one to hide behind that can't blame.
You know, I don't think I've ever read a Minotaur book that was really, really bad. And for some reason, they always get good authors in there. And I'm not saying that lightly, because I've read a lot of them. And
I'll tell them you said that. That's nice.
And I can't even think of one I didn't like. I mean, there are books you read, you open a book up, and you think, oh, I know I'm not going to like this book. And it does happen.
Yeah.
I don't like to think that way, but like I said, with your prologue, I had a little bit of trouble with the prologue, and then when I got into the story, I was fine. But I had to get into the story. It's a question of how long it takes you to start the story. And it didn't take long.
The prologue is not that long, so and it's kind of
exactly. I just there. Like I said, I just feel like I'm missing something when I read a prologue. I think, well, wait a minute, I didn't know this. It's kind of like, it's weird. I feel like I know it's going back in time, and I think, well, what did I miss? What do I need to know to read this prologue? Maybe that's what I'm feeling. I don't know.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense at all?
It does. It does. So.
do you ever have time to read?
Oh, yeah. Sure. I it's necessary. I read a lot for research. Number one, and number two, I read to try and grow as a writer, and the only way I think you can grow as a writer is to read people who are better than you and have some sense of, like, okay.
Well, you're very supportive of other writers. That's so important. I mean, it really is. I mean, you look at Lee Child, what he's done for other writers is just astronomical.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate. Stephen King has been incredibly supportive of me, and
do you keep in touch with Stephen King?
I wouldn't say that we have breakfast on a regular basis, but he's that he's read the books and he's gone out of his way.
God, do you know how that really gets to me to hear you say that? Because he's the ultimate. He's the one I want to interview more than any other author in this whole world.
And as far as I know, he's a terrific guy. And a terrific writer, obviously. Different genres, and someone whose ideas about writing are very, very influential and still very exciting after all these years.
And the short story book he wrote recently was out of this world.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just that fantastic.
And he still is willing to take chances and try new things and keep it fresh. And I'm a big.
I know we have to let you go because you have to go on tour soon. And I know where are you going on tour? What cities?
I will be going to Phoenix. I'll be reading at Poison Pen.
Oh, lucky you! God.
And Murder by the Book in Houston, and then I'll be in Los Angeles. Be at the Book Carnival in Orange, and then
oh my God, really?
Noble at the Grove. So
Is Ed still alive? The guy who runs the Book Carnival, or is it just his wife now?
I don't know. I've actually never been there before.
They're big Dean Koontz people out there. They're friends with Dean Koontz, and I know there used to be a husband and wife owner, but I'm not sure if he's still alive anymore. I seem to have a memory of talking to her and her hearing something, but I don't know. I thought maybe you knew, because usually authors know the bookstores before they even go to them.
Oh, no, this is going to be my first time, so I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, that is neat. That is really cool. I wish I were going with you.
Well, thanks for having me on, David, and thanks for reading.
It's been a pleasure. You're really a terrific man, and I love your honesty. I think your honesty is very refreshing.
I'll tell my wife.
I don't know why we have to, but the book again is called Proving Ground. It's out from Minotaur and all your bookstores now, and we will talk to you next time. This is David's Book Talk.
Thanks.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.